This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Samsung Galaxy S20s gode kameraer og enorme kraft for mye å håndtere for deg? Vel, nå kan du prøve telefonen I inntil 30 dager før du bestemmer deg for å beholde den eller ikke. Les mer om kjøp og prøv hos Samsung.com. Nå det ingen grunn til å ikke prøve en Samsung Galaxy.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In nearly 500 episodes of this programme, we've only been to China a couple of times. Luckily, we're off there again today, and we're heading a long way back in time as well, to the beginning of the 7th century, when a young monk crossed over the Himalayas to India. 16 years later, he came back laden with Buddhist texts and artefacts that many claim would change China forever. His name was Xuanzang, and he's our great life today. Travelling with us on this journey is the historian Michael Wood, who's done much of that journey himself. Tell us about this man, Michael, or this monk, I should say.
Well, it's a story that is as fabulous as a fairy tale. I first encountered it at university, actually, when a friend who was studying Chinese gave me a book about him by the great translator Arthur Whaley. This overland journey, the bringing back of the texts, gathering a team to translate the wisdom of Buddhist India, if you like, and initiating a cultural movement that spread Buddhist culture to East Asia, Korea, Japan, altered China forever. Maybe not only the culture of China, but the soul of China. And the other great thing about the story, I might say, is that it doesn't just end with his life. He becomes a folk hero. The most famous Chinese novel, Monkey, The Journey to the West, is a sort of fantasy version of his story. And so fascinatingly, he's a real person who became a myth. And I'm tempted to say, as I will today, that he's one of the great lives in the tale of world civilization.
You've travelled quite a bit of this route, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Two or three times through the western deserts of China. Actually, there was a bar on travel at that time, and it was with the help of friendly Buddhist guards in Gansu, I think, in the west of China, that he was able to slip by the guards and get out onto the Silk Road. There, China didn't rule at that time, and there were many different kingdoms, and many of these kingdoms had Buddhist monasteries and even Buddhist rulers, and so he got a lot of support on the way. But even then, the journey is a terrifying journey. You know, I mean, anybody who's been to the Flaming Mountains on the edge of the Taklamakan Desert, which means in Uyghur, go in and you'll never come out again, you know, and glowing like fire in the dusk, you know, it's an amazing spectacle. He had one period of 5 days and four nights where by an accident he'd lost his water and he had to survive those four nights with no water. So he was obviously a tough guy, you know, but also very charming, I think. Very, you know, tall, over 6 feet tall, handsome. People turned their heads as he walked by. I remember a Chinese friend of mine saying, oh, when he came back, there were crowds on the roofs of the houses and the women all turned their heads.
Did he see the famous giant Buddha statues at Bamiyan?
Yes, yes. He goes in this great arc through what's now, I suppose, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, the edge of, goes into Afghanistan, reaches the Bamiyan Valley, which then was a great centre of Buddhism with Buddhist monasteries. And, of course, the giant Buddhas, which were blown up by the Taliban, he saw in all their glory, the biggest one, 55 metres high with red coat and huge boots and a white face towering over the valley. It must have been a magical moment to reach that place, you know, and that's the last great staging point on his journey before he actually enters down the Khyber Pass and enters the plains of India.
I should add, Michael, that you're the eminent broadcaster whose work began with In Search of the Dark Ages back in 1979. More recently, you presented the story of China, and there have been programmes about India, Greece and England in between. Michael, you recently received the British Academy President's Medal for services to history and outreach. All I can remember is the tight trousers.
Well, you know, Matthew, I knew I'd really arrived when I became a Trivial Pursuits question. It was the jeans, but I only use them for gardening these days.
When did you first go to China?
Early 80s, so it's a long time, more than 35 years ago. And that's when I first encountered Xuanzang's journey. And since then, all these other projects, you know, following Alexander the Great across the Hindu Kush, Central Asia, and the story of India, I kept finding myself on Xuanzang's track.
Set the scene for us in 7th century China. What was happening in his time?
Well, it's an absolutely amazing moment in world history, really. You know, you think about it, it's born in 602. And actually, China had gone through a transitional period and dissolved into a lot of violence and civil war in the early 600s. But out of this was born the Tang Dynasty. And the Tang Dynasty is one of the great epochs of world civilization. I did a Vox Pops with the members of the Chinese public in the Shanghai Expo a while ago, and I went round asking everybody in the crowds, what's your favourite period of history? And I'd say 90% of people said, oh, the Tang Dynasty. And you ask them why, and they say, well, two things. Great culture and civilization, the arts and the poetry, of course, which is still alive today. And secondly, this was the time when China went out to the world and the world came to China. You know, they received missions, Christian mission from Eastern Mediterranean. And it's a very, very expansive time.
Now joining us on another line and from another place, except we're all kind of in the East at the moment, is another great Chinese expert, Francis Wood. Francis has written about the Silk Road, the Forbidden City, and Marco Polo too. As a former curator at the British Library, I'm hoping, Francis, that you can help us tie this man, Xuanzang, down a little and help bring him to life. How are we doing so far, Francis?
I think you're doing wonderfully well. I mean, Michael has brought in the kind of the big problem, in a sense, which is that you have Xuanzang, the real man, whose life was written by his disciple, Hui Li. And then we have the very famous 15th century novel Monkey, or translated as Monkey anyway by Arthur Whaley. So you have Xuanzang, who actually wrote a very sober account of his travels, and then you have the fiction, and the character of Xuanzang sort of, you know, veers between the two. I mean, a greater expert than me once said that the trouble with China is that it's very difficult to know whether you're dealing with the historicization of myth or the mythicization of history. And Xuanzang does sort of pivot perfectly between those two. In a sense, in the novel, he almost disappears as a character. He's not particularly interesting because the interesting characters are Monkey and Pigsy, who represent aspects of humanity which Buddhism is always trying to curb. So I think Xuanzang, I mean, he's a very, very significant figure. He was obviously a very serious person. I mean, his aim in bringing scriptures back from India was to translate the vast array of different Buddhist doctrines. He felt that China had only really had access to a very limited number. So he brings back this extraordinary variety of materials and translate them. But I'm afraid one has to say, in the long run, people in China, if they're going to chant the Diamond Sutra, for example, or read it, they prefer Kumarajiva's translation, which was made some hundreds of years before. Xuanzang's translations are supposedly more accurate, but they're quite dry. So he's frightfully important in Chinese Buddhism in a sort of doctrinal sense, in expanding knowledge of different schools. But for popular Buddhism, he's a bit of a failure.
You mentioned that he became a cult hero. He became perhaps something of a myth. How much is myth and how much reality? Do we know the difference?
Well, I think, you know, there are contemporary accounts of him from the 7th century and a life of him and works written by his disciples. So there's a huge amount of documentary evidence for his life. And indeed, his letters, for example, back to his old friends in India only fairly recently became available in English. So we've got the real life. But the other life, when you're standing in the new territories in Hong Kong at the time of the Hungry Ghost Festival and the processions of crowding the streets with the great marquees and the fireworks bursting your eardrums. And there is what they call the Tang Monk, the tall, white-masked figure of Xuanzang with his demonic companions and Monkey, who always gets him out of trouble in his adventures. And it's in the lifeblood of China. When we were doing our films, we discovered online a little six-year-old, seven-year-old boy who was so intrigued by the story that he'd got his dad to record him telling part of the story of Monkey as if he were a traditional storyteller, and his mum had run him up a red silk storyteller's jacket. And this became an online phenomenon, you know, and we actually put him in our film, you know. So it's, there's the living culture on that has transmitted all the way through Chinese history on the one side, which is still alive and vigorous, and then there's the actual story of that real 7th century person.
What do we know about his early years, either of you?
Well, I mean, he was born in a village near Luoyang, which was one of the old capitals of China. And the story goes that the centuries, 5 centuries before his day, the emperor had had a dream of a man with a golden body, 12 feet high, whose head glowed. And the diviners tell him that this must be the Buddha. And the emperor sends an expedition to the west to find out more. And they bring 2 Indian monks back from Afghanistan, and they translate the first Buddhist sutra.
We know that he had an elder brother who was a monk, and actually to have been admitted into a monastery, really much younger than he should have been, because he was, as Michael said, I mean, he does seem to have been quite a charming character. Even when we see him sort of travelling across India, travelling across Central Asia, in the hardest of conditions, he's always happy to sit down with people, usually to discuss Buddhism. So, you know, he's from the very earliest time of his life, he was serious about Buddhism and, you know, determined to pursue the faith, really, to the end of the world.
His childhood was spent in very turbulent times.
Yes, I think so. I think it's very difficult, actually, for us to imagine kind of what China was like in these periods of division. It's another of those sort of truisms about Chinese history that they say, no, the empire once united must divide, the empire divided must unite. I mean, Chinese history is this sort of series of periods of incredible success, confidence and achievement, interspersed with times when everything, the centre breaks down and there's fighting across the country. He grew up at a time when there were definitely sort of major warlords, if you like, ruling different parts of China and fighting, but it won't have been fighting all the time. And to some extent, I think monks were reasonably protected. When Sanzang decided to go to India to look for scriptures, there was at the time a ban on travel outside China's borders. But when he comes back, he's quite forgiven because they say, oh, well, we weren't really sure if the rules actually applied to monks. So there's an aspect of protection of being a monk.
Give me a sense, Michael, on these travels, some of which you have done yourself. Give me a sense of how he went about it. I mean, did he know where he was going? Did he have maps? Would he just sort of walk from one village to the next and throw himself upon the hospitality of the people that he met? How planned was it?
Well, I think the route, and Francis can add more to this, having written on the Silk Road, but the route into Central Asia, you know, this was a well-known route for merchants. So this was the most important of the land routes into India. So all the way was a trodden path. Wouldn't you agree, Francis?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, most people didn't make it the whole way. You know, one thinks of the Silk Road, you think people start at one end and go to the other. Most merchants would travel from one oasis to the next. And I think also one has to remember that from, you know, really from the Han Dynasty, when we were saying that Buddhism first comes to China, there had been travelling monks. And you have people like Fatien in the 5th century. And he travelled to India and brought back sutras. And he left a very detailed account of what he saw, the places he went to, which was very much followed by Xuanzang. And it's Fatien's account and Xuanzang's account of India that enabled archaeologists in India in the late sort of 18th, early 19th century to rediscover Buddhist sites using Fatien and Xuanzang as travel guides.
When you see the portrayals, of the depictions of him on inscriptions and in manuscripts, there's very famous, much reproduced depiction, of which an early version is from the Tang Dynasty, where he's walking with a huge backpack stuffed with manuscript scrolls. It's got a kind of frame-like contraption that goes over his head and has a light in front of his head so that he can walk when it's gone dark. And he's wearing sandals. Can you believe it? Sandals over the Hindu Kush. But I imagine that is just a fantasy, you know, because there are various points in the story where he does negotiate for horses, doesn't he?
Yes, and he gets given an enormous elephant, doesn't he, for his return journey, which is a bit of a nuisance because it ate so much and it was actually uneconomic.
But his fame must have spread as he went.
Yes. Oh, I mean, and of course, by the time he got to India, when he's welcomed in Kashmir, they are really awestruck that he's made this journey, you know, and the ruler of Kashmir gives him a jolly nice kind of apartment to live in a monastery overlooking the Vale of Kashmir, and lays on servants and people who can help him with the languages and so on, you know. So by then he was treated as not only a visitor from another world, but a much valued guest, you know. But he must have been caught in two minds over being given an elephant. You know, it's the last thing you want, isn't it, when you've got a long and difficult journey back? Yes, very kind of you, and it might be useful in the plains of India, but it won't be useful in the Taklamakan Desert.
Did he enjoy these travels? Well, did he enjoy travelling for its own sake, do you think, Francis? Does he in any sense of excitement come through his writing?
I don't find much sense of excitement. I really do think, I mean, he obviously was charismatic in many ways and charmed people really without sort of, in a sense, without meaning to do so. But I think he was so driven by his passion for Buddhist doctrine that he didn't have really that much time for enjoying places. And I don't know if Michael might disagree with me.
I mean, of course, what you want is him to write twice as much and to describe the places in great detail, don't you? And there are these flashes of, you know, he travels to Silk Road oases and he'll give you a brief portrait of the kind of people who live here, what the climate is like, you know, these godforsaken places in the middle of nowhere in Kyrgyzstan, you know. So he does give you that. But his aim was really on the great project. And, you know, if somebody had said, we wanted you to spend the next 2 years writing your brilliant autobiography, he would have said, I just don't have time.
I think you're right. And also, I do think you can't emphasise enough the great significance this had on places like Japan. You know, the numbers of Japanese monks who came over to China and who were absolutely enthralled by the amount that was translated at last into a language that they could understand. So really, Japanese Buddhism is created by Xuanzang and his Bureau of Translation.
Did he know what he was looking for when he set out? Was there an absolute goal, a destination?
What do you think, Francis?
I think his destination, his goal, was as much Buddhist literature as he could possibly carry on his rucksack, as Michael says, on his back, on his elephant. I mean, he was particularly interested in the Yoga Shastra school of Buddhism, but he was very aware in China that Chinese Buddhists were restricted to what had been translated. And what was translated from the Sanskrit was really rather kind of haphazard. It was, you know, what some monk had come across and found people to help him translate it. He wanted to be much more systematic and to gather really the entire corpus of Buddhist doctrine and take it back to China and translate it so that Chinese Buddhists would have access to the same array of doctrinal material that existed in India.
I think there was a place, wasn't there, where the Buddha first received enlightenment. I'd want to go there, make a kind of pilgrimage to it.
Yeah, he does. He does.
Oh, does he?
And it's a very touching story. You know, the journey leads him down from... He spends a couple of years in Kashmir, so he becomes fluent in the chief languages of Indian Buddhism, you know, and fluent in the arguments of the old school of Buddhism. You know, he's tapping the source here. What did the Buddha actually say? And then he journeys down the Ganges Valley into the heartland of India, and he goes to all the great places in the Buddha's life, you know, the place of his birth, the place of his death, and he finally reaches Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha received enlightenment, where still today, of course, you can go and by the wonderful temple of the Bodhi tree, or the descendant of the tree under which the Buddha gained enlightenment. And he actually describes reaching that place, reaching the tree, and going down on his knees and bursting into tears.
Run me through what he brought back with him when he returned to China, either of you.
Wow. I think that might be yours there, Francis. What is it, 597 different texts or something?
Yes, but what's always listed first, I think, is that 150 pellets of the Buddha's body, which always mystify me. Anyway, and a box of bone relics. So basically he brought back Buddhist relics, of which were obviously of great importance in popular Buddhism. He brought back images. I mean, this again, you have to think the difficulty of transportation. He brought back 2 gold, 2 sandalwood, and 1 silver images of the Buddha. 657 books are described. I mean, but it's very difficult to say what is a book. Are we talking about, you know, a bundle of palm leaves or what? But this included 224 Mahayana sutras of the greater vehicle, the Buddhism that he followed. So it was a considerable haul of items that were going to be scattered in different temples. You know, these pellets would be enclosed in wonderful little reliquies. You know, it's often in several. You know, get a silver reliquary and a sandalwood reliquary, and these would be placed in temples, objects of veneration. But for him, of course, it was the texts that were most important.
There are still 1 or 2 palm leaf manuscripts from India which have survived. And I remember a while ago asking to film them. And of course, you think it's going to be like filming in the British Library labs, you know, where you've got a kind of manuscript wearing white gloves and you're in an antiseptic room. And of course, they said, well, of course, they will be on the altar and we will be chanting sutras as well. So there, like a holy relic, is this fragile palm leaf manuscript written in Pali, the language of South India, that he'd brought back, and we filmed it with incense swirling.
Wonderful story, but both of you. I mean, let's just recap. There's this young Buddhist monk, relatively young, sets out on a strange but driven journey to learn more about Buddhism, presumably not with very much money, and mostly on his own and entirely unknown. He returns in what must have been a huge caravan with golden images and books and feted and welcomed everywhere that he goes. It's an amazing story.
It's great, isn't it? I mean, he's 20 pack animals, I think, carrying the manuscripts.
Yes.
And the news went before him. You know, the emperor, in fact, wasn't in Xi'an, he was in Luoyang. And so he had to go along the great trunk road to Luoyang, where the emperor greets him. And of course, the emperor, who was a bit of a wag, says, "Welcome back, Xuanzang, but you never asked permission to go." and as I said, thanks him for risking his life for the benefit of humanity.
What did he find when he got back? He'd been away for 16 years. Had China changed? What greeted him?
I think what had changed was a greater consolidation of the beginnings of Tang greatness. It must have been an era of fantastic hope and enthusiasm and, you know, nation building, as it were, and a great openness to the outside world. I mean, Chang'an was a city which was absolutely thronged with merchants coming from Central Asia, from Korea, from Japan, from Southeast Asia. It was a very, very bustling, busy and, I think, forward-looking place. And, you know, the Tang Dynasty lasted for another 300 years, but it was then building up to its glory. So it would have been a great thing to be in China at that time and to feel the, as it were, the burgeoning success of the Tang Dynasty.
What I love about it also is the open-mindedness. You know, we all view China as being a closed civilization, don't we? You know, stuck behind a great wall and resistant to the outside world. And here, you know, while Xuanzang was away, there's a Christian mission from the Eastern Mediterranean area, and they arrive in Xi'an, and the emperor interviews this Christian monk and his followers, and he gets the Gospels translated into Chinese, and then he says to them, well, this seems to be a faith that is beneficial to the whole of mankind, and therefore we've no objection to you preaching the faith in our country, and if you want to build a church in Xi'an, you can. And if you think the other way around and think about Anglo-Saxon England in the 630s, you imagine a mission from China had come asking to build a Taoist temple or a Buddhist temple. You can imagine the short shrift they would have got.
a question that has troubled me throughout. I'm still not entirely clear what this man was doing. Obviously, an incredible, epic journey, coming back with all sorts of guides, all sorts of things to increase the understanding of Buddhism. But did he bring any message of his own? Did he have his own interpretation of Buddhism? You know, the Prophet Muhammad didn't just report. He inspired people with a new sense of what God wanted, and Jesus Christ in exactly the same way. Was he an evangelist, or was he in the end just a sort of inspired historian?
What do you think, Francis? A transmitter or...?
I'm afraid I would say that he, in the end, basically, that it was the translation and the transmission of the gospel of Buddhism that was important to him, that he wasn't himself he wasn't a missionary. And I mean, well, I suppose that when he was travelling, he certainly demonstrated fantastic oratory and brilliance and being able to dispute with Hinayanists and Hindus and all sorts of people. But I think if you take the end of his life, you know, what he wanted to do was get away from it all to a quiet temple and translate and make this material available to other people.
I mean, what he brings back is a kind of hotline to, he's gone back to the source, to the most authentic version of the message, in the belief that the message is true for all mankind. And of course, the Buddhism, unlike Confucianism and Taoism, was transnational. And we have to remember that. But in that light, the question I wanted to ask Francis, really, which is that, you know, as Xuanzang himself said, the Confucianism and the native traditions of Taoism and everything had provided the bedrock of Chinese culture, and a great civilization had arisen. But he obviously believed that the message of Buddhism could add something essential to, dare I use such a loose word, as the soul of China. Do you think I'm going too far there, Francis?
No, I don't think, I mean, in what he believed, I don't think you are. I mean, one of the things that has always interested me most about Chinese Buddhism is that its intense adaptability. I mean, if you think about Buddhism, many of its tenets run completely contrary to the Chinese soul, as Matthew was saying. It does encourage you to leave home, leave your ancestors, leave your family, and not have any children. And in China, where ancestral worship is absolutely paramount, I mean, this is a major problem. But Chinese Buddhism adapts fantastically. It becomes very elastic. You get the development of the idea of sudden enlightenment. You don't have to spend all your life in a monastery, and so on. So I think what Xuanzang is bringing back in his kind of variety of materials is the possibility of Chinese Buddhism or of Buddhism in China adding to that great sort of moral background that Michael was talking about.
And did it?
Yes, I think it did. I think, I mean, in today's China, a sort of Chinese folk Buddhism is really the most widespread religious belief throughout China. Temples are still flourishing.
That's right. And that's why I found it so touching to go back to, you know, Xinjiang, where his ashes were committed in the 660s, and see the old monks who'd come back and see the tradition being carried on. You know, it's one of those great streams in the story of China and in the story of whole East Asia.
What a wonderful range we have in this series of great lives. Donna Summer, not long ago, Kenneth Williams, not long ago, and now Xuanzang. My thanks to Michael Wood and also to Francis Wood, no relation, I'm told, for bringing us the life and story of Xuanzang. Goodbye.
Å bygge hus en av de største investeringene du gjør I livet. Sørg for at det ditt eget drømmehus du bygger, og ingen andres. Opplev friheten. Fiskarheden Villan. Med Fiskarheden Villan.